Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the Israel-UAE Peace Agreement. With me to discuss the Abraham Accord brokered by the Trump administration, which will begin normalizing relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, is Martin Indyk. Martin is a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served twice as U.S. ambassador to Israel, first from 1995 to 1997, and then again from 2000 to 2001. Martin was also the U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations from July 2013 to June 2014. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Master of the Game, Henry Kissinger and the Art of the Middle East Deal. Martin, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Martin, I want to begin with some basics about this deal. Maybe I'll begin first off with its name. Why is it called the Abraham Accord?
Well, I think it is because Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, who is the moving force on the Emirati side behind this, has for some time now been promoting the idea of tolerance between the three great Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. He's opened a synagogue in Abu Dhabi. There's another one in Dubai. They're building a Abrahamic center where there will be a synagogue and a mosque and a church side by side. So I think that that's probably the inspiration behind the naming of the accord.
Well, now that we know where the name comes from, can you tell us a little bit about what the deal actually states?
Well, the deal is for full normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. The historic importance of this, and it is historic, is that there are only two Arab states up until now that have full normalization of relations, including embassies, ambassadors in both capitals, and that is Egypt and Jordan. So the United Arab Emirates will become the third Arab state. You know, it's sometimes hard for people to imagine that in most regions of the world, I think probably all regions of the world, countries recognize each other. It's de rigueur, but it's not that way in the Middle East. After the 1967 Six-Day War, in which Israel defeated the Arab armies of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, the Arab states came together in an Arab League meeting in Khartoum, Sudan. We'll come back to that, I think, it's because it's important that it was Sudan, and issued the famous three no's of Khartoum, which were no negotiations with Israel, no recognition of Israel, and no peace with Israel. And that has been essentially the standard for Arab states in terms of their refusal to recognize or deal with Israel, with the exception of Egypt and Jordan that made peace treaties with Israel, and of course the Palestinians that engaged in mutual recognition of the PLO and Israel in 1993, just before they signed the Oslo Accords.
Now, one of the major parts of the deal, as I understand it, Martin, has to do with the question of Israel's annexation or rumored annexation of significant parts of the West Bank. You were kind enough to come on the President's Inbox earlier this summer to talk about those plans. Can you sort of lay out what it is that the agreement says in this score? Because I'm hearing different things depending on whether I'm hearing the Emiratis talk, the U.S. government talk, and Israelis talk.
So the announcement itself didn't address this issue, but the annexation or the threatened annexation by Israel of 30% of the West Bank, including the Jordan Valley and all of the Israeli settlements, some 131 of them in the West Bank, was the cause of this breakthrough. I call it the accidental cause.
We'll come back to the reason for that in a moment.
The annexation idea came from the Trump plan for peace between Israelis and Palestinians, in which Trump designated territories for a Palestinian state in 70% of the West Bank, plus some 10% or so of Israel, as swaps for the 30% of the West Bank that Israel would get in the Trump plan. But they introduced an innovation, which I think was reckless, that allowed for Israel to annex, in advance of any negotiations with the Palestinians, to annex those territories assigned to it in the Trump peace plan. And that created a huge amount of blowback, first of all, from the Palestinians, who absolutely refused, arguing that unilateral acts like that are prohibited in the Oslo Accords. But it also produced blowback in the Arab world and from Europe and all over internationally. There was huge opposition of what was seen as an illegal act in international law. Now, for Mohammed bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, this was particularly alarming for two reasons. One was that he had been moving towards normalization with Israel, with some sense of urgency, increasing urgency, I should say, because of the concern about the threat from Iran, which is just across the waterway from the Emirates, and because of American retrenchment from the region, which left the Emiratis looking around for who they could rely on to protect them. They played with the Russians, they played with the Chinese, but the ones that are in the region are very capable and share a common sense of threat from Iran are the Israelis. And so he had wanted to normalize the relationship, take it out of the closet, so to speak, so as to be able to essentially develop a full-fledged strategic partnership with Israel, the better to deal with the threat from Iran and, oh, by the way, the threat that he also perceived from Turkey. Israel has very antagonistic relations with President Erdogan's Turkey at the moment. So he had the motivation, and the annexation with the blowback in the Arab world was making it impossible for him. Worse even than that was that it was threatening to destabilize Jordan. The annexation of the Jordan Valley, which is now under Israeli occupation, but used to be part of Jordan, would create a huge problem for King Abdullah of Jordan, who has 60% of his population of Palestinians, who has an intimate relationship with the West Bank Palestinians. And if there were to be Israeli annexation, he would see this as very threatening. He started to speak out vociferously against it. He has been a somewhat of a ward of Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed, who is very concerned that instability in Jordan could lead to the rise again of the Muslim Brotherhood there, backed by Turkey. And this is one of his worst nightmares. So the combination led him to feel that he had to take a stand against the annexation. And he did so by having his ambassador in Washington, Yusuf Alotaba, write an op-ed piece that appeared in Hebrew in Israel's largest daily newspaper, Yediot Ahronot. That is most unusual. In fact, I think quite unique in the annals of Israeli-Arab relations. And the message from Ambassador Alotaba was very clear, was that you Israelis can have normalization with the United Arab Emirates, or you can have annexation, but you can't have both. Understand that this will set back the relationships that have been developing over the years dramatically if you go ahead with annexation. And that, I think, created, together with King Abdullah's objections and the blowback internationally, created a situation in which Jared Kushner, the Middle East peace process head in Washington, decided that annexation really wasn't such a good idea. So he started to put the brakes on it. And then at that point, as I understand it, Ambassador Otaiba and Sheikh Mohammed decided to turn the whole equation on its head. Instead of no normalization if there's annexation, they said, how about no annexation and we'll do full normalization?
Well, let me just stop you right there, Martin. Is that in effect what the deal is producing? Because when I hear Emiratis talk about it, I hear about this is a deal that immediately stops annexation. We've, in essence, acted on behalf of Jordan and others in the Arab world. When I hear Israeli officials talk about it, I hear the words delay or suspend, which doesn't seem to convey the same degree of permanence that I'm hearing coming out of Abu Dhabi. Am I missing something here?
No, welcome to the ambiguity involved in Arab-Israeli negotiations, always involved, I should say. The genius, if you like, of this formula of no annexation for full normalization was that it not only helped to stop the annexation of the Jordan Valley and help King Abdullah of Jordan, but it also provided Sheikh Mohammed with cover for the Palestinians by being able to say to them, I stopped the annexation of your land. This is important because up until this moment, the policy of the Arab states had been determined by the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, in which all the Arab states offered Israel full normalization after the Palestinians' claims were satisfied in an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. Sheikh Mohammed was breaking through that glass ceiling that put a limit on normalization. Other Arab states in the Gulf had been moving in that direction, but he broke through and he needed cover for what the Palestinians inevitably would see and do see as a betrayal by normalizing relations with Israel ahead of a settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So it served a number of purposes. Now to your question about the ambiguity here. As I understand it, Prime Minister Netanyahu has agreed to suspend, if we use the word he uses, annexation for at least 3 years. This isn't written down, this isn't announced, but that is what I'm told the Emiratis understand he has agreed to. President Trump has said annexation is, quote, off the table. And Netanyahu, who faces a backlash from his right wing, who were very excited about the idea that they would finally get to announce sovereignty over all their settlements in the West Bank and the Jordan Valley and have the United States legitimize it by recognizing that annexation, are now also feeling betrayed. So there's two betrayals on the Palestinian side and on the right wing side in Israel. But it's clear that whatever may happen in the future, the equation has been established. No annexation for full normalization. And if sometime down the road something happens where the Israelis decide to go ahead and annex, I believe that the Emiratis will cancel their normalization. And the whole idea is to give the Israelis enough of a stake in normalization with the Emirates that they won't consider trying to push this annexation until it's been agreed on with the Palestinians.
I want to get to some of this domestic internal blowback on both sides on this issue, but just on this particular question of the significance of the agreement. Again, as I understand it, the Emiratis are hoping that in this three-year period, the Israelis will see enough benefits from normalization to not want to risk it with annexation. But is there enough in terms of either military cooperation, diplomatic cooperation, economic cooperation between the two countries on the table to make that happen? Is that a good bet?
It will depend on how the relationship develops. Ambassador Alotaba penned another op-ed piece in the same Israeli newspaper just recently in which he said he laid out all the potential benefits for Israelis, from duty-free shopping in Dubai, and Israelis love to shop, to the development of economic relations, the immediate cooperation on dealing with the coronavirus, all sorts of agricultural and technical agreements. The Emirates is a kind of hub for the entertainment industry. Israel, with its great TV series like the series Fauda, is also in the front row of this kind of development. And of course, Israel's high-tech industry, which is, you know, they call Israel the startup nation. The Emiratis have a great deal of interest in that, and I think would be interested in investing in Israel in these areas as well. The Emirates have a big alternative energy project, solar energy. The Israelis are into solar energy as well. The Emiratis have a strong interest in desalination. They depend, I think all of their water comes from desalination plants. The Israelis have cutting-edge technology that they've developed in that area. So a lot of things that could be developed between them. Whether it would be enough to stay the forces of annexation, unilateral annexation, remains to be seen. And we may come to a very early test of that before all of the fruits of normalization are born. And that's because it's possible, believe it or not, that Israel may go to a fourth election before the end of this year.
Wait. I thought we settled that. We had a unity government. That was off the table. I didn't have to learn the names of all the parties. We're going to go back to the voting booth?
Well, it's possible. It's looking now increasingly likely. The cohabitation between Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, the head of the Blue and White Party, has never gotten off the ground. Their extremely antagonistic relationship, made worse by the fact that Netanyahu did not consult with Gantz, who's his alternate prime minister, that's his title, and also defense minister. And he did not consult with him at all about the normalization breakthrough with the Emiratis, wanting to keep it all for himself and claiming now, in an insulting way, that had he told Gantz about it, Gantz would have leaked it. So it looks increasingly likely that the coalition government could fall apart.
Would it fall because Gantz decides to leave government? Or would it be that Netanyahu would decide there's a moment here for him to strike politically and he would call elections?
So Israeli politics are extremely complicated. But
can we get the 15-second version?
The 15-second version is if the government doesn't pass a budget, it automatically collapses and automatically you have to go to new elections. And they are fighting now about whether they're going to pass a budget. If they don't do it by August 25th, then the government will come down.
That's not too far away.
Exactly. They may work out a compromise, but it looks increasingly unlikely that they'll be able to do that. Now, the point about this re-annexation is that Netanyahu, if he goes to an election, will want to try again to form a narrow right-wing religious government, because that is the best way he can protect himself through legislation from the courts, where his trial is already underway on charges of fraud and breach of trust. He wants to try to stay out of the courts, try to stay out of prison. And so if he can form a narrow government, he may be able to get this legislation through. But he can only do that with the support of the right wing. And they will say reliably, as they did in previous rounds of the elections, immunity for you, Prime Minister Netanyahu, annexation for us.
Okay, so that's one pillar of this agreement that could crumble, sort of internal Israeli politics. Let's look at the other pillar. I take it that in the United Arab Emirates, there's not going to be vocal protest to reverse what the Sheikh has done. But there is this question of how popular his move is in the rest of the Arab world. You mentioned the Arab Peace Initiative 2002 that was led by Saudi Arabia. What are we hearing coming from Riyadh?
Silence for several days until the deputy foreign minister finally came out and said, we're sticking with the old Arab Peace Initiative formula, which is normalization will come, but only after a satisfaction of the Palestinians in terms of an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. The Saudis, I think, are reverting to their role as the kind of caboose on the peace train. For a while there, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was taking the lead. And he famously said on one of his visits to the United States a couple of years ago to leaders of the American Jewish community that it's time to get past this Palestinian issue. Palestinians have had their chance. They should have taken it before. We need to get on with normalizing relations with Israel. So clearly he wants to do it. And he wants to do it for another reason. Saudi Arabia is in bad odor in Washington these days, and not just with Democrats, with Republicans as well. And that's partly because of the war in Yemen that's causing the worst humanitarian crisis currently in the world. But it's also because of the murder of the Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, and the Crown Prince is seen to be responsible for that brutal murder in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. So I think, you know, he'd love to be the darling of Washington again for making peace with Israel, much like Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed is doing. But his father has a rather different attitude, it seems. He is more committed to the Palestinians. He's more concerned about what happens in Jerusalem. And I think that he's not ready to move. From Mohammed bin Zayed's perspective, that's just fine. So I understand that he wants to be the first mover and gain the benefit of doing that, particularly in terms of his relationship and standing in Washington. Why? Because he wants some sophisticated arms from the United States. And he calculates that just like Egypt, just like Jordan, when they made peace with Israel, received a bounty of sophisticated weapons, that he too can benefit in the same way, except he's paying cash, whereas they received it courtesy of the American taxpayer.
And the Emiratis want the weapons because they're worried about the Iranians, which is a shared interest of the Emiratis, the Israelis, and the U.S. government, correct?
That's correct. And the Emiratis are particularly keen, have been since 2011, for almost a decade, have been trying to get the most sophisticated fighter in the U.S. arsenal, which is the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. The Israelis have had this fighter for a number of years, but because the United States has a commitment to maintaining what's called Israel's Qualitative Military Edge, QME, the United States has not been prepared to sell the F-35 to any Arab country. As you said, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed wants the F-35, the better to deter the Iranians from attacking his very small country across the Gulf from Iran. And of course, he would have same aircraft as Israel. And because they're entering into a strategic partnership against Iran, they would be able to fly together, as it were. So I think, you know, he has plenty of reason to want to try to get this. And to see the full normalization as the way to break through in this regard, the opposition in the United States to providing him with those weapons. President Trump has now said that the United States will be prepared to provide F-35s to the United Arab Emirates. This, of course, is a bilateral U.S.-Emirati deal. But because of the commitment to Israel's qualitative military edge, Israel does have some say in the matter.
Okay, so it sounds like from the vantage point of Mohammed bin Zayed, things are looking pretty good to the extent that he hasn't gotten support from Riyadh. That's not necessarily bad news. It could be good news in a way. Certainly a very different reaction than, let's say, the Egyptians got back in 1979 when they were essentially ostracized by the rest of the Arab world. Now, you've talked about how the Trump administration has reacted to the news of the deal it helped brokered. And I take your point that you see the administration essentially backing into this deal by, I take it, putting annexation on the table, and that sort of kicked over some things and they realized they didn't want annexation. How is the deal being viewed more generally in Washington by people who aren't in the administration? Is it an opportunity, a great success, or something that sows the seed for more troubles down the road?
I think there's a consensus in Washington at a time when there's such deep division on so many issues. When it comes to Arab countries making peace with Israel, there's a consensus in welcoming it. And I think there's no question Biden, the Democratic nominee for president, has come out strongly in favor of it. Speaker Pelosi, Leader Schumer, everybody on the Democratic side.
Is that because they like the substance of the deal or because it essentially takes what looked to be a potentially divisive issue in the Democratic Party off the table for now? Again, there's been growing criticism among, whether you call them progressive or left-wing of the Democratic Party, of Israeli behavior. Vice President Biden's been critical of the idea of annexation. Now that issue goes away, at least for the time being. Or is it that they buy into this on the substance?
It's both. It's both. But while it takes annexation off the table and removes that as an issue within the Democratic Party, but I must say that leadership of the Democratic Party was against annexation as much as the progressives in the party, but it doesn't take the Palestinian issue away. And to the extent that this is seen by progressives as hurting the Palestinian cause, undermining their efforts to pressure Israel to move on the Palestinian issue, that I think will become an issue again. And it's exacerbated by Prime Minister Netanyahu's crowing about this to his Israeli public, saying, you see, we didn't have to give an inch of territory. We didn't have to do anything for the Palestinians. What we got was peace for peace. He omits the fact that he got peace but had to give up annexation or sovereignty. So it was, in a way, peace for sovereignty. And he also argues now vociferously against the idea that it's a peace for arms deal, and says that he strongly opposed the idea of the Emiratis getting F-35s. But as I said, that's going ahead. It's a U.S.-Emirati deal. And if he strongly opposes it, it could crater the normalization deal as effectively as new annexation would do so.
So where does this all net out, Martin? In particular, what does it mean for an issue you devoted much of your career to, the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? We're not going to have, at least anytime soon, though, as you point out, depending on what happens in Israel's domestic policies, things could change. But we don't look like we're headed toward movement toward annexation anytime soon. Does that mean the two-state solution is back on the table, is still viable, or is it still in intensive care and not likely to be revived?
It's difficult to say at this juncture. We have to see, in a way, how things play themselves out. I'm not optimistic in this regard, partly because the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians has become so difficult and toxic and so full of distrust. And this, I think, at least in the short term, is going to make matters worse rather than better for two reasons: a sense of Palestinian betrayal, being left behind. The Palestinians in their current state are unlikely to say, gee, our strategy hasn't been working, we better try something else. Maybe we should look again at the Trump plan. They're more likely to dig in their heels and play the victim and complain. On the Israeli side, as I already mentioned, the notion that you can get something for nothing is very attractive. The idea that there's a free lunch here, a free lunch in Dubai, is something that I think will make Israelis less willing rather than more willing to take difficult steps that will be difficult internally because of the divide between the left and the right on the issue of territory in the West Bank, I think they'll be more reluctant to take steps in that direction. And Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed has not conditioned his relationship with Israel on progress on the Palestinians. So I don't see that it's going to provide much of an incentive there. But on the other hand, and I think this is the positive dimension in terms of the peace process, you have another Arab state, an important Gulf Arab state, normalizing relations with Israel, recognizing Israel, willing to have live in peace with Israel. The Minister of State for Foreign Affairs of the Emirates, Dr. Anwar Gargash, said very recently that there will be an end to the belligerency between the two countries. There'll be no more resort to use of force, not that there was before, but they seem to be willing to commit to that. And that hopefully would lead to a process in which other Arab countries normalize. Oman, Bahrain have been moving in that direction. Qatar's had a relationship under the table with Israel, and eventually maybe even Saudi Arabia. Morocco, Sudan, where the original negative resolution came from, the Sudanese are now talking about normalizing their relations with Israel because they want to get off the terrorism list and get sanctions lifted here in the United States. So if that leads to a kind of momentum in which Israel finds itself enjoying greater acceptance in the Arab world than it's ever had before, maybe, I'll be accused of being naive, but maybe the Israelis will come to see that they're not as threatened, that they don't need to worry about their neighborhood. It's no longer a hostile neighborhood, and that they can therefore afford to take more risks for peace when it comes to being more generous towards the Palestinians.
I would take it in that scenario you just drew out, Martin, that there would be fewer places for Palestinians to turn to for help and support. And I think that would have consequences as well.
Well, you know, you could argue that instead of succeeding in isolating Israel, which is what their strategy of anti-normalization was, they've only succeeded in isolating themselves, and that therefore they need to rethink their strategy. I think that that would be important for them to do now. But Abu Mazen is an old man now. He's not in the best of health. It's unlikely that he's going to be flexible enough to make kind of strategic adjustment that would come from recognizing that they're essentially being left behind. Yasser Arafat did that in 1993. Fearful of being left behind, he reached out and grabbed the lifeline that Yitzhak Rabin offered him, and that's produced the Oslo Accords. But I don't see Abu Mazen doing that. And so I think that there's going to be a reckoning that will come later after a succession process and a new leadership emerges there, which will be, I then think, in a position to think again about the strategy that hasn't worked out for them. In the meantime, despair is not a good solution for Palestinians. And I wish that Israelis would recognize that they may be the winners here when it comes to the Arab world, but until and unless they resolve their conflict with the Palestinians, they are not going to have the real peace and security that they so desire and deserve, because those Palestinians essentially living among them, especially because of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and also in Jerusalem, where you've got 300,000 Arabs in Jerusalem, Palestinian Arabs. So I think that Tom Friedman used to say that the Israelis have won, but the Palestinians are never going to let them enjoy it. And that's essentially where they are today, even though they're looking forward to enjoying relations with Abu Dhabi. They need to find a way to resolve the Palestinian problem for their own sake, not for America's sake.
Just one final question, Martin. Is there anything else out there that could scramble this picture that we spent some time describing?
I think the F-35 deal has the potential to do that, because the Emiratis have put a lot of weight on the arms sale as part of the package where they give to Israel in terms of full normalization. Israel stops the annexation and green lights the F-35 sale, which the United States then makes to the Emirates. And they feel that Netanyahu has in fact given a green light to this. But now that it's come out in the public arena in Israel, he's denying that vociferously and saying that he will oppose the F-35 sale on the Hill. And if that happens, we could end up with quite a fight when the administration notifies Congress of the sale, which it's required to do. Not only will they have to address America's commitment to maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, but Democrats and even some Republicans will be concerned about whether these aircraft are going to be used in Yemen or in Libya, where the United Arab Emirates has aircraft deployed. And I think it could become quite contentious if Netanyahu signals that Israel is opposed to it, contrary to what he led the, or let's say what the Americans led the Emiratis to understand on behalf of him.
Do we know, Martin, when the Trump administration is likely to make that notification to Capitol Hill, or perhaps more sharply, is that notification going to go up before November 3rd, Election Day?
It's unclear at the moment, but here's the complexity of this. Donald Trump wants a signing ceremony before Election Day. Blessed are the peacemakers. He thinks he can generate some buzz about the success of his foreign policy.
Well, and he's also spoken quite a lot about arms sales generating jobs in the United States.
Indeed, and this would be a big one worth tens of billions of dollars. So for him, there's political advantage in getting this deal wrapped up before the elections. But my sense is the Emiratis will not appear on stage with Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump for a signing ceremony unless there's a notification of the F-35s. So I think it could move, and there's enough time for it to move before the elections. And so this could become very complicated if Netanyahu takes a stand against the sale and the Emiratis feel that he's reneging on what they understood was the arrangement. Now, there's a related question here, which is, do F-35s in the hands of the Emiratis threaten Israel? And I think, in my view, there's no reason for that to be the case. First of all, the Emiratis aren't trying to acquire them to use against Israel. They'll be involved in some kind of non-belligerency pact with Israel. They want them to deter Iran, much like Israel has its F-35s for that purpose. Secondly, there's a long history of Israel getting the aircraft first, ginning it up with their high-tech capabilities, getting extra capabilities that the Arabs aren't sold. That was the case with the F-15s, the F-16s that are in the hands of the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Egyptians, and so on. And thirdly, the Emirates is a long way from Israel. Those planes can't get there without refueling, which would make them vulnerable. So I think there's a lot of ways of dealing with this problem that the United States can do. And in the end, I think it will likely go ahead as long as Netanyahu doesn't queer the pitch by deciding to go all out to stop it, which would in effect be seen by the Emiratis as a kind of hostile act in the circumstances.
Okay, Martin, my takeaway from all of this is that just because you have an agreement doesn't mean you have a deal. Nothing is ever easy.
Especially in the Middle East.
I'll put that ad on, especially in the Middle East. My guest this week on The President's Inbox has been Martin Indyk, distinguished fellow at CFR and former U.S. ambassador to Israel. Martin, again, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to The President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also pulled double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.